Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. Just wanted to let you know that the book launch is now official. I will be talking to the incredible, I'm so excited about this, Fee Glover, of fortunately podcast fame and also radio fame, on January the 17th at Earth in Hackney in London. If you head to Fane Productions, that's F-A-N-E, you can get your ticket. And we have also launched an amazing It's just a free badge. It's not a competition. It's a free badge. So if you have pre-ordered and you upload your proof of purchase, you can get a free badge designed by Griefcast logo hero, Jade Perkin, who's an amazing artist. She designed my logo and also did a children's book about grief called Mum's Jumper, which is so beautiful. So I was so excited. She's done a little pin badge, which will be sent to you for free. If you head to the Instagram or the Twitter at the Griefcast, you can find the link to get your badge. And if you head to Fane Productions, you can get your tickets for the book launch on January the 17th at Earth in Hackney, London. And the book, of course, as I've told you, comes out on January the 19th, 2023. So please do get your pre-orders now and you get a free badge. This week, I'm talking to the incredibly talented novelist, filmmaker, television producer and playwright, James Runcie. He's written a wealth of things, but he is probably most famous for the Grantchester novels, which have also, of course, been turned into a television series. And he has a new book coming out tomorrow, if you're listening on the day this drops, so the 24th of November 2022, called Tell Me Good Things on Love, Death and Marriage, which is such a beautiful book. James is just a very, very beautiful writer. And the book is all about his wife, Marilyn, who passed away in August 2020 from motor neurone disease. And that's who we're remembering today. So, James, who are we remembering today?
We are remembering my wife, Marilyn Imrie, Marilyn, who died in August 2020.
So really recent. I count that as very, very recent, August 2020. And also died in such a difficult time. Obviously,
yes.
Like in the middle of the, well, really the start of the pandemic. We'd had a lockdown, we'd come out of it, but no one knew what was going on. So what did Marilyn die of?
Motor neurone disease, which is a very terrible illness, which is, as people know, a gradual paralysis, basically, and it either works from the head down or the feet up. You don't have the choice. And it's very hard to predict how long it's going to last. It's known in the trade or colloquial as the 1,000-day disease, 1,000 days from diagnosis, but it can last a very long time, as in the famous case of Stephen Hawking, or it can last a very short time. And the doctors are very, very unkeen to diagnose it. They talk about the aches and pains of aging. They talk about, well, it may not be this. And it's the last thing they want to say. They're the three words, motor neurone disease, that they dread saying, because it is a complete death sentence. I mean, it is fatal in every, there's no recovery. You can't fight it or battle it. You can try, but you can't. And there's no prediction of how long it will be. So you look it up and it says, at Marilyn's stage, it said 6 months to 2 years. And I asked a friend who's a doctor, and I said, well, 2 years. And she said, well, no, it could be 6 months, James. And in the end, it was 5 months, 22 days from a very late diagnosis. And that was, well, it was so slow and fast at the same time. As you know, death and grief, they can operate at different speeds. The timescale is so weird. In a pandemic, it was incredibly insane because people were scared to come to the house, and doctors were even, you know, very, very masked up, and they looked like they were in hazmat suits, and friends couldn't come. Now, in a way, that was a good thing because Marilyn didn't want anyone to see her deterioration, which was horrible, and she wanted to be remembered at her best, at her smiling, best dressed, happiest best. So virtually nobody saw this slow, well, not always slow decline into paralysis. And finally, the most awful thing of all, speechlessness. So you can't actually communicate. It was a very difficult thing to do. And I did it with my daughters, and we decided to try not to go to a hospice, which we did twice for 5 days. And we wanted to keep her at home. She wanted to be at home. And there is one advantage in that you can prepare and you can talk, and Marilyn was able to prepare her own funeral with me and talk about what she wanted and talk about what our life and marriage had meant. And you are supposed to do all these things like come to terms. I always find that phrase a bit complicated. Come to terms with one's own death, or come to terms with what's happening. She never came to terms with it. She didn't want to die. And she was 72. And we'd had 35 years. So everyone said, well, you've had a good lot of time together. Yes, yeah, yes. And I'm grateful for that. And actually, you know, to try and fold in gratitude to grief is one of the great challenges. But that doesn't mean it's sort of easy, or you read a few books and learn how to do it. So you have to process it. All these words now have inverted commas around them, don't they? Yeah, process it, come to terms with it. These inverted commas sort of say so much, because you kind of think, well, sort of, but there's no, just as you know, they say with motor neurone disease, every case is different. Every grief is different, and it also it's different every day. So it's like, I mean, this came in a pandemic, and grief itself is like a virus. It keeps mutating in different ways, and just when you get to one stage in the nursing, just when you get to one stage, you find out how to use a ventilator, or you find out how to use a walking frame, then there's no walking possible. So you then, hoist arrives, and you think, wait a minute, I'm not a nurse. How do I work this hoist? Rosie and I were sort of manipulating this hoist, and Marilyn could still just about speak, and said at one point, I said, you're all right. She said, I used to be a glider pilot. And I went, what? You never told me that. She said, yes, I did glider pilot in my 20s. And I feel like I'm just going to close my eyes and pretend I'm gliding a plane over the fields of Fife. And so that was like, she was very determined to be as confident and obliging and as happy as she could be in the face of a sort of desperate, depressing unhappiness. So that was a challenge, and you could see her trying to be happy. And we watched lots of telly, you know, and we listened to lots of music. And I found it rather bizarre, because the people who did come are priests. My father was a priest, and he died. And when he died, and my mother both died. And when they died, my father died of prostate cancer, and my mother died of septicemia. And priests would come, but they'd come for 15 minutes, 20 minutes with a script. You know, they had a service, they had prayers. And then off they went, leaving you with 23 hours, 40 minutes in order to try and say something or just be with somebody. And I know just being with somebody is what you have to be. Knowing what you have to do doesn't make it easier to do.
No. So when was she diagnosed? After the pandemic had started, then?
The day before.
Oh my God, James.
The day before. So it was insane. We were in London and we got back just in time. And then there was lockdown, yes. So the hospital bed that was delivered to, they put it, did manage to get it inside the front door. And that was sort of about it, really. And there was a very lovely woman who came and taught us how to use a ventilator. And you have to, like in all these things with illness, which some people weren't prepared to accept, you have to be ready for the next stage before it happens. You have to anticipate the next stage. And anticipation, I think, is a big thing in terms of grief and in terms of death, you know, because you can anticipate. And I had, because I'm a writer, I'd written about, I wrote The Grantchester Mistress, Sydney Chambers. His wife dies in the course of the last book in the series. And my children said, I hope you're not proud of this, because the wife is obviously, she is, Hildegard is a kind of version of Marilyn. And I was trying to prepare, and I've always dreaded it, dreaded death, the death of a loved one. I've always dreaded the death of my father, dreaded the death of my mother. We always dread it. But actually, anticipatory grief, I don't think it's that helpful, because when grief comes or when death comes, it is different to anything you could possibly have imagined. Yeah. And even if you, and you know, even if you've been through it once, you kind of think you can do it, but actually it's different. It's the death of a parent is different to the death of a wife or a loved one or a child.
Yeah, and I think, as you know, we were saying before, like, grief is completely unique because it's based on the relationship of those two people. When they are together, what, you know, chemical magic conundrums, reactions happen. And once that person is gone, it's different for everybody. And so, yeah, you can, especially when someone has a terminal illness, you can sort of, I mean, you know they're going to die,
yes,
but you also don't know. You also absolutely don't know, even though if someone said to you, do you know they're going to die? You would say, yes, I do, they're ill. But there's another part of your brain, I definitely felt, was like, I don't think they will, because you just haven't, it hasn't happened yet.
Yes.
And it's so hard to actually, until someone is properly dead and you see them and you think, wow, that is it. It's really hard to get your head around, especially in the middle of the pandemic, James. I can't imagine what you were, because everyone got so involved with themselves. Obviously,
yes,
everyone had so much to deal with. Whereas normally, in that situation, I imagine you would have had people, like you said, rallying round and helping.
Yes.
Everyone had something to deal with.
Yes. I mean, friends did leave food at the doorstep very helpfully and very nicely, really nice, and brought flowers and all of that. So that was there. But it was quite a lonely, focused, concentrated time.
Yeah.
You know, and that was, that was difficult. And everyone, you know, and you have these, obviously you have irrational bits of fury. I mean, I think fury and anger is part of it all. I mean, Rosie and I, shortly after Marilyn died, we went for a walk, and this neighbour was very pleased about getting, he's one of the first to be vaccinated. And he said, I'm going to have my vaccine because I'm going to be 80 on Saturday, and I'm going to have it for my, it's going to be my 80th birthday present. And after they left, Rosie, my daughter, said, did you just hate him because he's 8 years older than Marilyn and he's still alive and he's having a vaccine? And we would swear at Gardener's World, some man on Gardener's World saying, I think I've got 15 years left of gardening in me. And we thought, yeah, good for you. Bully for you. So you would have strange fits of anger. There's that Wordsworth poem, strange fits of passion I have known. Strange fits of anger I have known. Because you do know someone's going to die, but you don't know when. And you have no idea when. And so you have these extraordinary moments of thinking, well, is it going to be today? Is it going to be tonight? And what do we have left? Do we have a week left, a month left, 2 months left? And we had four to 5 hours of caring towards the end, where incredible carers came in all masked up and everything, but they were fantastic for food, feeding, and, you know, toiletries and all that kind of stuff. And I would look at them, they'd say, no, was it? But when somebody can't eat or and then can't swallow, then you do know you're in the last week. But you end, we said, I mean, I said goodbye four times, and the third time I said goodbye, it was, I thought, really, this really is it. And she could hardly speak. And so it was a very one-way conversation. And I talked about, you know, everything that our life had meant. And she just said, enough. Because, yes, shut up, basically. Because she couldn't answer back. And
Yeah,
no, and that's
saying all this stuff. She wants to say, yeah, I remember that. And you're like, yeah, yes, I love you.
Yeah, I know. Stop wittering on. And in the end, you know, you play music and you hold her hand and, you know, and you learn about how important lighting is, you know, candles, smells, nice perfumes, anything to try and take away the horror of what's happening, you know, but you're both in the moment and out of it. I mean, it is like a dream. And then the other weird thing is it happens. The cold fact happens. You know, your wife is dead, not a sentence you thought you'd say. And then you find yourself saying sentences over the next few months before Marilyn died or when Marilyn was alive or when she... You think, well, I didn't... That sentence isn't coming out of my mouth like that. What, when Marilyn was alive, what do I mean by that? And then you live in this sort of hinterland and you know life will never be the same again. You can try and make it the same and same things happen. But, you know, I've all of these manifestations of grief, you think, well, I suppose I better get some food. And you go to Sainsbury's and you think, well, what? It doesn't matter. Like the apple, orange, tomato, I don't care. Lettuce. What do I do with all these things? And friends said, I mean, my friend Julie gave me a book. She came to see me immediately. She was allowed. And came with a book called Solo, The Joy of Cooking for One. And I said, what the fuck is this? There's no joy in cooking for one. What do you mean, the joy of cooking for one? Fuck off. She said, that's not very grateful.
You're not quite at the stage where you're ready to be like, yes, how wonderful. I only cook it for one person.
Yeah. The and then you do. Like, and then, no, of course, I try them. I try to make them. And then, of course, you remember Marilyn cooking. And then everything is freighted with memories of Marilyn and the meals we had. And then you cook and you manage to make something rather nice. I can't remember, but, you know, some vaguely Ottolenghi type thing with couscous and recipes that might as well begin first flight to Beirut to pick up the herbs. And you put them all together and then you put them down on the table with the white wine and with the telly and you think, well, what do I do now? I suppose I watch the telly, I suppose I eat this. And then what do I do when I've finished eating this? What do I do? I've got to clear it away. And then I've got to go to bed, which is a whole other area. There's nobody. You turn to the left and, oh, nobody there. And so it's a very, you know, all those sort of degrees of everyday life. And you go to the bathroom, for example, and then you remember Marilyn always used to complain that I never put the bath mat back. And I thought, well, I'm certainly putting it back now. I'm putting it back every day for the rest of my life, this bloody bath mat. I've done it.
Yeah.
I did put the bath mat back. That's a lie that I never put the bath mat back. And you end up, and then, you know, all these things. I mean, you know, you go and you're drowsy in the morning, you make the coffee and you pull out the two mugs of coffee and then you go, oh. And even a year later, I went to see my friends Tom and Sue, and Sue was preparing lunch and everything, and we were just talking away. And she got the plates out, and she said, oh, I've got four plates. There's no... And, you know, and it goes on, and you think, oh, have I... What's going on? And, I mean, we had only a month ago, I went to a party in a posh big house with a garden. And two of the guests bounced, and I was having drinks in a room which looked out into the garden, and these two lovely men bounced up and said, "Hi, James, how wonderful to see you! And where's the lovely Marilyn? Is she in the garden?" And I said, "No, she's dead." They said, "What?" I said, "No, she's dead. I'm really sorry to say dead, but she is actually dead." And they said, "But that she can't be. That's impossible." I said, "I know, it's impossible, but it is possible, and yes, it has happened." And I was speaking to some bloke, and then they turned to the bloke and said, "So, is this your new partner?" I went, no.
You no, see,
this poor innocent man was horrified that I might be his partner. You know, and you feel churlish because it's 18 months, it's going to be 2 years in August, and should one have got over it by now, in inverted commas, should one have moved on? Well, yes, some of the time, yes, I have. Some of the time I can function perfectly normally. I can absolutely be normal. You wouldn't know anything was wrong at all. Absolutely fine. And then, you know, I'm sure all of you guess that one of the real problems is people being nice.
Yeah.
I don't mind shits. It's the nice people that are the problem. People who are just concerned, or Marilyn's friends, Marilyn's best friends, or... You know, those kind of people who miss her, and also people who then people who are lovely and say how close she was to them and talk about her, and that's both nice. And you want to say, hang on a minute, my wife actually, you know, you know. So you want ownership, and that's You have to share, you have to be very as generous as you can be with grief and share it and help other people who've lost a friend or lost a mother in the case of my daughters. And you have to do that. And but we're there. My daughters are really, my daughter and stepdaughter are really sensitive to this and have been brilliant. And but of course it does affect them in a very different way than it affects me. And grief is different across a family. You know.
Definitely. And Jay, I just honestly, I am so moved to tears by what you're describing, because I think you're capturing so perfectly the tiny domestic things that happen in grief. And it, because I think what people expect is like, oh, I went to the sea and I wailed. And actually, it's like you said, it's the plates,
it's the bath mat.
It's these stupid little things that you want to say, oh, I thought grief would be grander. I thought grief would be, you know, Greek tragedy, but actually it's the bath mat. And I think so many people relate to what you're saying, of like these tiny ways that it just keeps, it's like, you know, it's like being stabbed by a compass, isn't it? It's like ow, ow, like tiny little ows that eventually you're like, oh, it's quite a big painful scar now.
Yes.
It's like, I know individually these are very small pains, but gathered all together in one day, I'm in a lot of pain. And I think so many people relate to what you're saying. It's just hard. And honestly, I hear this all the time from people early days in their grief journey of, two years, to me, nothing. It's nothing. It's too, you know, if you were married for 2 years, people wouldn't be like, wow, you've been married for ages. Like,
yeah,
that's
exactly,
so boring.
Yeah. That's absolutely
God, how do you
true.
Guys find anything to talk? Yeah, someone's been dead for 2 years. You had them in your life for so long. Like, one, you don't get over grief. And two years in the space of a life, especially that you said the two of you had left together,
yeah,
family together, it's nothing. Of course you still have those moments, of course it's still hard. And I think the first year, we always say on the show, the first year is such a blur, it's
yes,
such chaos, you don't know how you existed, but you did. That the second year offers quite a lot of other, you're more aware, I think,
yes,
the grief, and you're more sort of like awake, perhaps is a good way of expressing it. Because the first year, I think, you just wake up and then it's been a year. And you think, oh,
yes,
I suppose it has. But the second year, you're like, oh, I know it's coming. I can see all these things now. Like,
yeah, that's absolutely true. And there are sort of issues. I mean, obviously, birthdays, obviously, anniversaries, obviously, the dread that is Christmas. And the summer holiday and places you've been and where do I go, then the sort of lunches with friends, and then the I'll have to make up a name here, the positioning of Sophie, a widow. Sophie's lost a husband, you've lost a wife, you know, maybe you'll get on with Sophie.
Oh God.
And you kind of think, well, no, and you feel really sorry for Sophie, who's been landed with this sort of grumpy, swearing, alcoholic widower who's a bit of a lovey, and she'll go, what? Him? Are you mad? You go, no, Sophie, no, it's all right. It's okay, Sophie. I'm not, you don't have to go out with me, it's okay.
Yeah. But the idea that you would pair people up just because they've both known someone who's died, they both love someone who's died. It's like,
yes,
there's, I mean, yes, you can have a great chat probably about grief and what it means, like, but it's not necessarily going to be, so do you want to go to the pictures with me? Like, it's like,
I know.
People find, they did it to my mum said this, they did it to her a lot of like, oh, well, you know, well, now you must need somebody. You've got two mugs. Well, what, you know, you can't have one mug. And she was like, what if I'm fine? What if,
yes,
like, I'm sad? But I'm fine. I don't want to hang out with somebody else.
Yes.
It's like maybe that's, but people do find it hard, and that is their way of helping, but it's a very weird way of helping, really, because, you know, it's as if you can replace somebody who you'd love,
yes,
all that time. I mean, if she was still alive, they wouldn't say, well, are you bored? Do you want to meet Sophie? She's lost someone.
Yes, I know.
Just because Marilyn isn't here doesn't mean that you can just fill that gap.
Yes, it doesn't. And I'm being slightly disingenuous, and I have to confess, I do actually currently have, I have a girlfriend. And she's...
Nothing wrong with that.
And she is absolutely fab. But of course, that... And I don't want to sound like a spoilt person. I have checked with her if I can talk about this, and she says, yes, it's fine. But, you know, she is great. She's absolutely great, absolutely lovely. That doesn't mean... There are two things. It doesn't mean I don't miss Marilyn, and I don't...
Yeah.
feel that Maren said, and there are complications that, I mean, buying her birthday present, for example, you think, well, I don't know, jewellery. And then you go into look at some jewellery and you think, well, if it was Marilyn, I'd know what to buy. But I don't know. I mean, what do I do? I buy some of this? And if it was Marilyn, this. And actually, love after love is a very complicated thing because you can, just like if you have a second child, doesn't mean you don't love the first.
Yes.
You know, there is that. But there was a very... Now, this is alarmingly intimate, but I'm going here, so okay. Stay with me. So towards the end of Marilyn's life... Yeah, that kind of sentence, what... You know. Mm. Anyway, towards the end of Marilyn's life, obviously, the nights were quite difficult because her breathing became incredibly erratic. She always had intermittent breathing, but there would be pauses... And then a big intake of breath and then a big long pause. And towards the end, I would think, oh, well, is this going to be it? Is she going to die tonight? Is this going to be it? And I would dread, and though I couldn't sleep because I didn't want to miss the moment or I didn't know whether it was going to happen. So I had this sleeplessness while listening to Marilyn's breathing. And obviously then there came a night when her breathing did stop. So early on, with Lucinda, because that is her name, she was asleep. I was telling her a story about an opera I'd seen which ended with somebody in tears. So it didn't end with the music, it ended with Dido and Aeneas, Dido crying. And I was telling this story, I thought, rather well. It was about midnight. I was telling the story very well. And Lucinda fell asleep in the middle, and she fell deeply asleep. And I didn't know she was a type of fall, deeply asleep.
Yeah,
and I said, are you listening? And then I thought, oh... She's not actually breathing.
Oh, God.
I thought, oh for Christ's sake, she's dead. She's dead. I've been this woman 2 weeks and she's dead too. What the fuck? She's bloody died on me. And
oh, James.
So I have to wake her up.
Of course.
She said, what are you doing waking me up? I was asleep. I said, no, I thought you were dead. She said, don't be ridiculous.
You're like, no, I come from a place where people were talking to me and they were dying. So, of course, I'm on edge.
And she said, God, you're such a catastrophist. And I said, yes, because I've had a catastrophe.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. We call it on the show death anxiety. And I think, I don't know anyone who hasn't suffered it after, a really big, shocking grief or someone who's been very ill because... And I was in therapy for a long time and my therapist kept saying, not everybody dies, Carrie. And I was like, yes, but somebody did. Somebody did. And so my evidence is quite strong. You know, like the test I did, the lab I went into, the dad died. So, of course, when people don't text back or they look like they're sleeping too heavily, of course you think, oh, my God, they're dead. Because that's your lived experience. So, that would be really bad luck, James.
I do, and it would be like, quite bad luck.
That would be really, I'd be really like, oh no, that is awful. So I'm glad that didn't.
No, she is still alive.
It was just a very boring story about opera, clearly.
I know, it was clearly a terrible story. I'll just pep it up next time.
Yeah.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
But it is, you know, you do, people say, you know, I'm glad you've moved on, or I'm glad you found somebody.
I see, and that's what you mean, is it's not, that's really interesting to me, because, like, things can be true at the same time. Like,
yes,
you said, that you have a new girlfriend and you are happy, but it doesn't mean you have moved on in the way that that person didn't matter.
I think happy is pushing it a bit.
Sorry, apologies.
Steady on. You're with the word
on,
happy.
Steady on, yes. Calm down on that one. Catastrophist.
But no.
It's almost like the language fails us, doesn't it? Because
yes,
what they mean,
well,
is,
obviously I have happy moments and happy times, but then you do. Yeah, I'm an utter catastrophist now.
Yeah.
And obviously, yeah, you do. It doesn't go away. And I have to tell the children, particularly the children, I have to say, look, it doesn't mean I don't love your mother, you know, and it's absolutely true. And it is possible to love more than one person. And you just live in this way in which, you know, weird conjunctions happen. So here's another little story, which is, so we were having supper the other night and Lucinda was chopping a cabbage with a knife. And she said, I can't, my wrist isn't strong enough to cut this, cut through my, I don't know, something's happened to my wrist. I said, stop.
Yeah.
Just stop, right? I'm really sorry. You cannot complain about wrists being, not being strong enough. It's just too close to motor neurone disease. Mm. I'm really sorry. Please don't, give me the cabbage, give me the knife. I will cut it. Just don't refer to any weakening of muscle strength. And she said, I know. She said, I'm really sorry. I said, well, I'm really sorry to raise it, but it was instant flashback to Marilyn picking up a saucepan and going, I can't carry this. You'll have to carry it. And so, yes, saucepans, bath mats, two cups of coffee. That's where it all hits. You're having a perfectly nice evening. Mm. You've got a new girlfriend. She's lovely. It's all nice. Music's playing. She's cooking. You're cooking supper together, just like old times. And she suddenly says some fatal thing. Mm. And totally unconsciously, and you both go, oh no, that's it for the next half hour, because she's referred to waning muscle strength totally accidentally.
Yeah, and that's the thing, I think, like what you're describing is like the complexity of grief that I think people find really hard to get their heads around, because what they want is a really simple story.
Yeah.
Like,
it's only a bloody cabbage.
Yeah, that's very sad. His wife died, now he has a new girlfriend. I imagine he's fine. They want the fine to be true, because that makes them feel better. That makes them go, oh, if anything happened to me, I would be fine and I would be okay. Rather than the complexity is, yes, this moment is lovely, but then I have a flashback of this moment. And there's so many truths at the same time in one's life. But I think we find it hard to give people the complexity they deserve.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And then the funny thing is that, I mean, I've had two most bizarre experiences. One is envy. You're lucky, James, because you found love again. I'm still stuck with the same husband. wait a minute.
Oh, yes. How lucky.
Yeah.
Well done,
lucky.
Me.
I'm glad, so glad my wife went through all that so that I could be happy again. And then some woman in St Monans in this village in Scotland said to me, well, you're really lucky, James. I said, really?
Am I?
am I? She said, yeah, because you think you're a writer, you've got your imagination. You can go into your imagination. You can have an imaginative life rather than a real one. I said, the imagination's not always an advantage, I have to tell you.
Yeah,
imagination can make it worse. You know, there is a chance that imagination can actually make it worse.
My mum always said, someone came up to her in the supermarket, like not that long after my dad had died, and said, oh, you're so lucky. She was like,
what?
Right. And she said, well, because I'm divorced, so he's still here. I have to deal with him. And my mum was like, yeah, but I didn't want him to be dead. Like, what is the comparison? Well, it's easier for you. Like, as if like he was like a bin that had gone, you know, like the rubbish has gone. Well, that's better. At least we don't have to look at him. It's like, I think some people just do not think before they speak, because to say to someone who's lost someone in such a painful way, in such difficult times, you're lucky, is like, no, I would disagree with you heavily there, that luck is involved in watching someone you love die from a terminal illness is not lucky. And like you said, the imagination thing's really, I think, as right, you know, I have recently written a book all about grief, and that you definitely have a place you can put these feelings. But like you said, the imagination is a really powerful thing. It's like having a dragon, isn't it? It's like, yeah, sometimes it's great and it destroys things I don't like, but sometimes it burns my house down.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
It's like, I'm not always in control of this imagination. Like, I don't always get to decide what it's up to, you know?
Well, it's like your dreams. You can't control your dreams. But I think this is why what you're doing is so important, because lots of people don't have the language around grief, you know, the language around it, or they're embarrassed by it. And it's different in different countries. You know, in Ireland, people cross the road to say you're all right, or rather than avoid you. I think that we don't really, I mean, because priests and doctors, they have this language, but what one might call non-priests, non-doctors, I try to avoid the phrase ordinary people, as if they're not ordinary, but we're not comfortable around it, because you don't really, we want a bit of small talk, or we want a bit of conversation we can cope with, and you're always terrified. People are so terrified of saying the wrong thing, and that you end up talking about the weather and then or something, in fact, well, after my dad died, I had to cancel his bank account. So I went to Lloyd's Bank in St Albans, and the cashier said, I'm very sorry about this, you know, when did he die? I said Saturday, and they said, oh, we had a good day for it. Sunny day, great. Thank God for that.
People say, I just like, I guess sometimes people, like you said, it's just like their mouth just opens and the first thing comes out. It was sunny, great.
Yeah,
congratulations. He was so pleased.
I know, he was
not to go when it was raining.
Oh my God. I know. So those kind of mad things people say, and you think, oh, gosh. And obviously the world is divided between people who've lost parents and people who haven't, and people who've lost partners and people who haven't. And, you know, the letters from people who'd lost partners were incredibly moving. And, you know, for example, there's a difference between a psychiatrist who said to me, you can phone me any time, but Saturday afternoons are best. to my friend Rachel, who just sent me a text saying, you can phone me any time, I mean it, any time. And so that's kind of ways of dealing with it and to be there for people. I'm not necessarily very good, but my friend Rachel, you know, her husband went off for a bike ride and had a heart attack, and just that was it. And so we've talked about the difference between, I mean, neither is good. The sudden death without warning, and then the long, well, not that long, but the 6 month warning, which we don't know is 6 months, but the 6 month warning where you have time to get used to it. And obviously, neither are advisable.
Yeah, I think we've had that on the show as well. Lots of people have said, lots of people who've lost people suddenly to heart, you know, a heart attack or got the phone call, have said, "Oh, I wish," you know, the terminal illness, and the terminal illiss gang are like, actually, you know, obviously there's no one wins. That's the thing.
Yes,
nobody wins, because, you know, one is such a terrible shock and you don't get to say anything, but the other one is you watch someone in so much pain. And also the thing I've often said to people with that query is, like, my dad had a terminal illness, but he didn't talk about it. Like, he didn't want to, he was like, I'm not dying. So you can think, oh, well, we're going to get this time to talk about it, and the person might not have a conversation with you. And you can equally have the sudden death but someone has previously had that conversation. Really what matters is the conversation, like, have it before, like, get those conversations in. Did you find that, you said Marilyn planned her own funeral, like, was that really a helpful thing that you'd had those conversations?
Yes, absolutely. And also instructions. I mean, lots of instructions. This came from my dad, who planned his own funeral and came down to supper once with a brown envelope with the event written on it, the event, and put it on the table. And Charlotte, my youngest, was only 10 at the time. And she said, what's that? He said, it's plans for my funeral. And she burst into tears. And and my father said, don't worry, I'm rather looking forward to it. And so the idea of having a funeral, so planning the funeral, music and what the music would be and who would do what and everything. Yes, we had that. And then we had, we were sitting looking out to sea at one point, and we the doctor said, never mind this lockdown business, just take her to the sea and just, you know, just, and here's a letter that you can show anyone who stops you. So we went to look at the sea, and she said, now. It was quite early because she could still speak. And she said, now, I don't mind if you marry again. We went through the service, and she said, I don't mind if you marry again. I said, you do? No, I don't. I said, no, you don't. You have to be buried with me. And so there was the burial, you know. So we did the service, want to be buried, not cremated, want to be buried here by the sea. You have to be buried with me. She said, I really don't. I said, you do mind? She said, no, I'd rather you had a string of affairs with women, none of whom live up to me. You know, they're all...
That is the right answer, Marilyn.
I said, I'll do my best then.
Yeah.
She said, also, my stepdaughter's 41. Nobody younger than Rosie.
And, oh, I love her.
Yes,
I love
and
her.
You must, you know, you must protect the children's interests and nobody ghastly or embarrassing. And, those are the only conditions, really. Age, not ghastly, buried with me, you know, that kind of thing.
But, like, that's so incredible that you were able to have that conversation. That is an incredible thing. And not lucky, just I'm glad that she was able to say that. And I think those are, like, excellent life rules of, like, not younger than one of the kids. Like, that... Yeah. You know, that's when you're going to make her feel a bit uncomfortable. So let's, push just up higher.
Nobody off the internet in a foreign country. Not having you going to Latvia.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So it was that. But then, of course, all of this planning. The other thing I think you talk about quite a lot is sort of writing things down in notebooks and keeping things. And obviously I've written a memoir, which was really helpful writing down certain things about planning the funeral or about Venice, a place we went to quite a lot, or about her clothes. And in the process of writing, I was able to remember more. And that was, so I thought, I've forgotten that bit. And also there were some risky things like looking at her notebooks and looking at her, she used to do lots of drawings, looking at her drawings and memories of holidays and all of that. And obviously you're very wobbly about remembering times that, you know, when you, the rows you had, you know, the arguments you had or difficulties. So you have to watch the old regret bit, which is obviously an enormous bit sometimes. I wish I hadn't been so stressed about stupid work at the BBC. I wish we'd had more time on holiday. I wish I hadn't carried my work home with me so much. I wish I hadn't been so stressed. I wish I'd been a better parent. I wish I'd been a better husband. All of that kicks in and then you have to. So then I suppose the advantage, the word advantage, the advantage of some kind of one bit of the terminal thing is you can show how much you love someone as they are dying, and you can be in service to them and really prove it. And I don't think Marilyn was in much doubt that I loved her in that time. And so that, because of that, I have less guilt about, you know, not being good enough, or, you know, because she had an ideal dad, which is always a slight problem, because obviously I couldn't live up to her dad.
My husband's very grateful for my slightly disorganized, not perfect dad.
I'm
not one of those people who, like, I feel for my daughter because I think my husband's such a good dad. I'm like, oh mate, this is unusual what you're dealing with.
Yes, I know. I must learn to tell my children the advantages of having an inadequate father.
Yes, tell them. It works out.
It means my son-in-law has got an easier ride.
Yes.
He's not like dad. So I mean, yeah, I should say Sean, he should be more grateful. They don't like... I went through a phase of thinking it was funny to be embarrassing dad, because it annoyed them so much.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, this is quite a laugh, being embarrassing.
No, it's
not.
Awful.
It's not actually a laugh.
Yes, just, that's what my dad did. And I was like, never got to explain to him fully of, like, it actually was embarrassing. Like, it wasn't funny. It was just embarrassing. You were laughing, but just you, me, my friends, the other parents, all not laughing.
Yeah, so, just because you think it's funny doesn't mean it is.
Yeah, it was a good life lesson. You know, we've all got to learn these lessons. But I think that's, you're right. You do get, and obviously what happened to you, you know, like you said, you got to be there for her at the worst of times, in that sort of cliched,
well, there was no choice
way.
There's no choice. It becomes a job. It is your full-time job, so you have to stop all other work and do that. And as we know, time stops for a death, and time stops for a terminal illness. Yeah. And that is your job. You have to do that. And there is no choice. Well, unless she said you could just leave me. I said, are you mad? You know, why don't you just leave me? And there was no, obviously because of the pandemic, there was no discussion of Switzerland, you know, the Dignitas. Although there might have been, had it been diagnosed earlier. I don't know whether we'd ever have done that. Because there were some warning signs that were put down to other things from about 2016. And then it was August to December was there was something seriously wrong, that she was so frightened and she hid things from us because didn't want us to know. So she hid lots of painkillers and there was a fall that she didn't tell me about, you know, and which is where you started to, you know, where it started to go horribly wrong. But I don't know whether we'd have done that. That's a conversation that has no help because I don't know whether we'd have done it or not. I think we probably wouldn't have done it because you do want to survive for as long as possible and you do want to stay at home for as long as possible and you want to be in your own home. But it does mean, of course, the bedroom is a place where she died. And although there was a hospital bed, so it's not our bed, but that is still problematic. And obviously everyone who's been through this knows about the problem of the clothes or the scent or shoes, handbags, jewellery. So again, she bequested a lot of the jewellery and I have 10 pieces that are lovely and are in my drawer, really. I don't know. I mean, obviously I'm not going to wear earrings or a jangly necklace, big jangly necklaces. But the clothes are part, they're still there, you know. And she was such an ostentatious dresser that it's hard to know what to do. We can't really bear it anyway. So that's all part.
And that takes time, you know. I think that's the other thing is people, if you haven't been through it, you don't realise like the amount of time it takes to face things like that. Like, it's not like you go, right, okay, they're dead, we buried them, time to open the wardrobe. Like, it's not, and it's hard because you're right, caring is a job and it becomes quite rigid and structured. Like, okay, 9 o'clock you do that, we do this.
Yes.
But grief isn't structured at all. Grief is this just mess on the floor. And, you know, I've said it on the show before, but like my dad's ashes were in the wardrobe for 10 years.
Well, gosh, yes.
10 years. And we just kept thinking, oh, we should do something with dad, shouldn't we? But like, we just, no one was quite ready. And now I don't feel bad about it at all. Like, nobody was ready. And when you are ready, you feel it. Like, that's the thing. It was such a change. And I think the house is really, what you're describing is really interesting. Like, my dad worked from home and he had a study and it took a long time for us not to refer to that as dad's study.
Yes.
Like, you know, and then it became like, you know, it's got a cot in it now, it's where grandchildren sleep. And it's, you know, if you say the study, one of us would be like, what room? Oh, right, yeah. Like, then that took years. And also it took years for like the smell of him to just not be in that house because it was a tiny study and he's a smelly man. And then, you know, it just takes... Yeah, all of that stuff is, I think the thing is, like, everything's on a different timeline, you know, like clothes and jewellery and memories and what a house meant, like, that is on a totally different timeline to, like, you being able to go to Sainsbury's and not burst into tears or, you know, being able to have dinner with friends and not feel like this is too painful. Like, everything's on a different one.
Did you find going to his study helpful?
Yeah, I did. Weirdly, what I found, we kept the door closed. Actually, I've never said that. We kept the door closed for ages. And I found the door being closed helpful because it was like, it was like maybe he's behind there.
Yeah.
And actually, when it was open and it was just like this empty, you know, this had been this really intense office of someone running their own business from our house, you sort of would see this emptiness. But it was actually the door closed, it being there, just being there, made me sort of think, well, in a way it feels like he's closed the door and he's still in there on a phone call trying to do something, trying to set up some intranet meeting in America. And so I wouldn't, going in there was quite tricky, but I would do it when I was in the mood, you know, when you're in the mood to open that feeling, literally open that door and go, oh, he's not here, okay, how do I feel about that? Sad, okay, well, I'm gonna close the door again. But just having that space there, I suppose it was such a literal metaphor, you know, if you put that in a book, it'd be a bit much, wouldn't it? Like, I found that helpful.
But it's, so there's a bit of, I mean, obviously, I have a gravestone with my name on it.
Oh, wow.
Which is quite challenging sometimes.
Yeah,
and I go, It's in Scotland, but I go every 2 weeks and I stay there for a few days. And it's a really beautiful graveyard above a church in this village, St. Monan's, on the hill. And it is odd seeing on it. And I try to make sure that, well, I do make sure there are lovely flowers and a mixture of flowers all the time, and I take them. And there's some very, very nice fellow mourners, you know, lovely, who are tidying graves and everything. And you have these, you know, bizarre moments, because early on, I didn't really know what to do, how long to stay, how to behave in a graveyard, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I'd sort of do the flowers tidy, make it tend to it and everything, and then stand there and look at it and look out to sea and have a little think and everything. And a neighbour came over and said, "Are you having a bit of a chat?" And I said, "Well, sort of. I'm just not getting very much back." I went and had a little explanation about Lucinda. You know, I said, "Look, I'm really sorry, but this, I mean, it's not my fault you died." And so we had a row in my head, you know, with my dead wife, you know.
James, that's so brilliant.
I said, I think she's, you know, and people say to me, "Oh no, Marilyn would be very happy for you." And I thought, I don't think so. I don't think at all, actually. I think she'd be pretty fucking furious.
And I think that's what I love about people who can talk about grief, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, to not put them on the pedestal, be like, "Oh, how wonderful." Be like, no, she'd be pissed off. Like,
yes.
She'd be annoyed. Look, she'd get over it. She understands. But she would definitely have the first reaction and be like, "Oh, I see." And that's...
Didn't take you that long, did it?
But I love that so much, because that's how you know a person. Like, that's the truth of a person. When you deny that truth, it's like they didn't exist.
Yes.
And it's like you're talking about someone and you're like, "Well, I don't know the person you're talking about." Like, people said to me all the time, "Oh, he was such a wonderful father." I was like, "No, he wasn't. He wasn't." Yeah. Don't say that. Like... Be honest, be like, "He was great sometimes and he was complicated and mad and interesting," but don't lie about who he was, because then I can't grieve for that person. So
yeah. Well, Marilyn was officially a saint and everyone very loved and everyone. Yeah, she was wonderful. She was absolutely wonderful. I mean, completely wonderful. But that saints are not always easy to live with.
Yeah,
And there's, and so she was utterly fantastic, and there are lovely things about it. Gives you some kind of insurance for the rest of your life to know that you were loved, and you loved somebody and you know how you loved. And it does give you, as well as you are in the, you know, this afterlife, this love after love world, but this afterlife and this, your life goes on without the person you spent all that time with. So there is that. But you do, and what you have to try and do, I think, is try, if you have had that, to be thankful for that.
Yeah.
And it was very important. And with the memorial service was ages later. It was only, it was, you know, 15 months after she died.
Because of the pandemic,
Yeah. We had a funeral, which was just 11 people in this graveyard, which was very beautiful. Yeah. And then we had this massive memorial service, which was fantastic, with the service that she had planned with all her favourite music and wonderful musicians and wonderful actors, because she was a theatrical person. And it was fantastic. And I was determined to end on a thankful note. You know, I'm determined to end on, however, you know, a happy note. So she had a theatrical round of applause, you know, which was a 2-minute round of applause, and a bit of Dusty Springfield at the end. You know, "You don't have to say you love me." Sing along, you know, behind masks. The masks. Never mind the masks sing. What about the masks sing along? And I was determined that there should be some a celebration of her life. The fact that she lived is more important than her death. And also the other thing is that try to not let the illness define her life.
Yeah.
Try not to let the last 6 months, last year, 2 years define her life. Because before all of that, even though in those 2 years she was still magnificent in many ways, she was completely magnificent before the final illness. And you have to remember that. So, you know, 70 out of 72 years, or 71 and a half out of 72 years were fantastic.
Yeah, that's so important. That's so important. And that is the journey you go on with grief, I think, of like, at the end of someone's life, all you can see is that you're so close to the bomb blast, and then you sort of zoom out slowly and you can see them, and you start seeing, remembering them well, and those memories, and that is the part of grief, of is sort of balancing those two truths, like that there was this awful death and it was very horrible and painful, but there was this life, and these both these things exist in this person, and that's what makes made them them, and that's I just think,
and you try to carry them with you, try to believe in that sentence that's often at funerals, death is nothing at all. Well, that's not true. But you do try to carry them with you. You know, I think that's a Bastille song. You find out you end up speaking in song lyrics before you know it. But there's something very... Well, you try to make it hopeful. So I know that the rest of today, I've got to do other things, but because we've had this conversation, I will be able to take Marilyn into the rest of the day. And it is armour. It is some kind of protection against things. You can't get to me because I've had Marilyn. So you can actually shut up. You can't. You can be snotty to me at the BBC, or you can diss my book. I don't care because I've had Marilyn, you know. So, you know, you try to put that armour around you, the armour of love, you know. You try to have it as some kind of protection.
Oh, James, that is such a beautiful, beautiful way to describe. I'm like welling up again because I just think to be able to say that about someone and to be able to give that to someone is really such a beautiful thing. Thank you so much for talking to me about
it. It's an utter pleasure, and thank you for all that you do, because I think that you're doing now you're going to make me cry.
We're both going.
So we have to stop now. But it's amazing. Amazing what you're doing. It's such an important thing. And it's so helpful for people. I think it really, really matters.
Who said
comedy can't be serious?
Thank you so much. She sounds so brilliant. It was really nice.
Thank you. Well, lots of love. Thank you for everything.
James's book, Tell Me Good Things on Love, Death and Marriage, is out tomorrow, the 24th of November 2022. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. If you head to his website, jamesruncie.com, R-U-N-C-I-E, is how you spell Runcie, you can find all the information about his other books, his plays, his events, and everything that he's up to. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, the book launch is happening on January the 17th at Earth in Hackney in London. Head to Fane Productions to get tickets to that. You can pre-order my book, You Are Not Alone, as well, which is out January the 19th, 2023. The show is edited by Kate Holland, music by The Glue Ensemble, artwork by Jade Perkin. I think that's all I have to tell you. I'm sorry it's so admin heavy at the moment, but obviously the book coming out, there's lots of events and things. So if you listen this far, thank you so much for bearing with me in the admin heavy part of the show. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate so much all the lovely messages that you send me. This feels like a secret Easter egg, because who's going to get this far? Anyway, if you have, thank you so much, and remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.